Hello and welcome to this Canadian Opera Company podcast sponsored by Decca, the opera label. My name is Jana Wichlow, and today I'm joined by three guests who have taken part in our online book club in which we've been discussing Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, the inspiration for Benjamin Britten's opera of the same name, which has been in performance this fall at the COC. Tanner Allen Oak is portraying the role of Gustav von Aschenbach. Thank you, Alan, for joining us today. Welcome also to Jennifer Dougal, the COC's digital marketing manager, and Cecily Carver, our social and interactive media coordinator. I got those right?
Yes. Okay.
To start things off, we've all read the Thomas Mann novel, along with our blog readers, and we've read it in English, as opposed to the original German. And I'm just curious to know which translation or translations you've read and how you felt about them.
Yeah, I've only recently read this newish translation by, what's his name, Michael Heim. Before that, I was familiar with the older one, and I've completely forgotten the translator's name.
Helen Tracy Lowe Porter.
Exactly.
That was from 1930, exactly. And Heim's from 2004.
Which was the one we kind of all knew, who knew the book before this new translation. And although it's obviously the same story and a lot of the same language, in fact, this new translation, for my money, opens the thing up more. It makes it more readable, not easier actually, but just it sheds light into corners of the text which are not missing in the older one. The other one is old. The older one is rather thick in texture. Of course, that may reflect the German better, I don't know. But then we're reading in English.
That's right, not in the original.
I wish I could read it in German. I can look at it, but I couldn't read it fluently enough, unfortunately, because apparently it's remarkable in German.
Did you end up reading both? Or?
I did. I was sort of look for the poetry, I suppose, and there are aspects in both novels that I was actually lifting excerpts and comparing them, and there are aspects to both that I found very compelling. And I'd find it very hard to pick one, but I agree with what you say, Alan, that it does feel more crystal, more sort of clear.
Transparent.
Well, yes.
The text is a bit more transparent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like it's been put less close together on the page. I mean, it hasn't, but that's the impression.
Just reading it, this edition here, the pages are more generously spaced. There's actually more pages.
Well, that might help.
Yeah, literally.
That might help. Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the tone between the two translations? You know, the way the story is actually depicted, the way von Aschenbach's entire story is depicted. If you've read both.
I only read the one.
I only read the old one as well.
You read the old one, and Jennifer, you read
one.
The newer one.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, in the foreword by Michael Cunningham to this new translation, he says that he thinks Aschenbach comes over slightly more sympathetic.
Mm-hmm. I agree, yeah.
I'm not sure if I got that entirely. He still comes across as pretty, well, certainly at the beginning, pretty stuffy, very self-important. But then, of course, I'm coming at it from a point of view of someone who has got to know Aschenbach through my performance.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I sympathise or empathise with him in a different way from someone who's just reading the book.
Have you seen the film?
Oh, yes. Yes, several times.
And how do you rate the film in that experience?
Well, I'm not a great fan of the film, to be honest. I think he rather... Well, there are things about it that irritate me. For instance, the banging on at Mahler's Adagietto from the Fifth Symphony over and over and over again. Visconti discovered rather like in the same way that in Platoon you get the constant repetition of the Barber Adagio. The Mahler Adagietto going over and over again, I find that a little wearisome. And it's also, to me, the film is just a little bit too glamorous, too much like a sort of eye candy type confection. Although, of course, Venice is very nice to look at, but it's not really the point of the film, or not really the point of the story, beg your pardon. And also the boy, I find the boy a little implausibly gorgeous, but in the wrong kind of way.
He's stunning.
He's stunning,
sort of
but
like a young woman. He's just got the most exquisite features.
And the long hair.
Long curling hair,
yeah. So, I'm not a great Dirk Bogarde fan, so there you are. I mean, I'm sorry.
I was a huge Dirk Bogarde fan, but yeah. I saw the film when I was very young, and I loved it. Mm-hmm. And we watched it just recently.
Yes, we did.
And you know what? It's really paled for me. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. seeing the opera for the first time live mm-hmm. and reading the book again, the film slipped. It felt very in your face, I suppose. Mm-hmm. It seemed to boil the story down to a sort of more histrionic kind of telling.
Well, the thing is, the book, of course, is completely not in your face. The book is implied. But for a start off, there's very little dialogue, mm-hmm. few lines of dialogue only. So then to make that into a film, I know I guess he does stick to that business of not much dialogue in the film, but it's a little bit too, as you say, explicit, or all the goods in the window. Whereas I think the opera, although we never stop talking because that's opera for you, I hope that it goes back to being what the book is. I think it does. Whereas people have to work a bit harder to figure what's going on, and it's rather implied, not rather than explicit.
I think it's a pretty remarkable adaptation. If you think of what the librettist had to go through to do it, and I'm very curious as to what she picked up on. For example, I only found three instances of this where, in the opera, you have the traveler and the same artist sings multiple roles, and it's potentially seen, I suppose, as this, I don't know, death figure or someone leading him somewhere mm-hmm. or some fate figure. And in the book, I picked up at least three characters who were described physically the same way. And I suppose the librettist picked up on that and said, well, maybe let's have the same singer sing all the eight roles. What do you guys think?
Take something that's implicit and makes it explicit in the opera. And it seems like a lot of things work that way in the adaptation, and it's quite different from the film, whereas because in a film you can't have someone addressing the audience and explaining their feelings, whereas in an opera that fits very well with the operatic convention. So it's interesting that way. It can take the things that are implied in the book and then have someone state them outright and do things like make all those three characters into the same figure, which is implied in the book, but more explicit in the opera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, short of having a narrator in the film, you're left with Dirk Bogarde making faces because he has nothing to
looking
say.
Sad. Right.
Looking slightly worried or looking more worried, less worried, happy, less happy. That's tricky. But as you say, it's nice and easy for me in a way because I tell people what I'm feeling, or show it and say it.
Well, speaking of nice and easy, you're on the mm-hmm. stage the whole time, aren't you?
Yes.
That's unusual.
I suppose it is quite unusual. Yes, I can't think of many pieces. The other one actually is Satyagraha, where I'm playing Gandhi, which mm-hmm. I did at the same time recently, and that's all, he's also on stage the whole time. As I said to somebody else the other day, it's hard, but it's also somewhat easier as well, because you don't have to come off stage and then come back on again and start again and redo your concentration. You're there, being the person from point A to point B, which is the interval, and then point C to the end. In that way, it helps. And it's not, I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not like going down the mine. I mean, it's not that grueling. Let's not get it out of proportion. And also, he's not singing the whole time he's on stage. There's a few sections where he's observing, like in the Games of Apollo and so on, where he's having a bit of a break. Although he doesn't take a break from the point of view of being watched, I'm sure, because I'm sure a lot of people in the audience are always looking or having the odd look anyway, to see how he's reacting, see how it's going down and so on.
I was just emailing with Tiffany Fraser from Props on the subject of strawberries, which apparently mm-hmm. was a bit of a crisis for Sunday's performance. But one of the things she said was that she tries to find the nicest strawberries for you to eat on stage, because if you eat them and they're bad, you don't have a chance to have a glass of water in between.
Oh, right, yes. Yes, and actually there was a couple of shows ago, I thought, oh, these look quite dark. And actually, they were just on the cusp. You know, there was one I had, and as I do have to eat, well, I don't have to eat them, but I do choose to. I get sold some strawberries on the beach. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I have to have at least one, because there's maybe an implication that they are diseased or haven't been washed whatever. Yes, I do have one, but I do sometimes I have about three or four because it's quite nice at that point to have some something moist, you know, and rather than a drink, if I haven't got a drink of water, a strawberry has to do. And one of them was quite whiny, so I was pulling a leg afterwards. But, and then, of course, the last show, she said there'd been some storm in wherever she gets to strike, in California maybe, I don't know where the strawberries came from.
Yeah,
and it was, she had to scour Toronto. Mm-hmm. She had to go to some place that froze all fruit salad and said, I only want strawberry salad. And they were good.
Yeah.
And then, of course, at the end of the piece, I have one which is supposed to be bad, which I spit out. Symbolically.
Good to know what other departments in this company go through.
Yeah, that's right.
Speaking of the Games of Apollo, one of the things that came to mind with the differences between the book and the opera is in the book you have Tadzio's perceived frailty. And one of our blog commenters, Annie, was asking what other readers might think of, you know, the fact that Tadzio is perceived as frail in the book. And also, what we don't get, I believe, in the opera is Aschenbach in the book taking pleasure at the thought of Tadzio dying young. What did you guys think of
right.
that?
For me, it sort of felt like that was one of the things that united the two of them, is that even though Tadzio was quite young, he still had that edge of the frailty and the potential to die young. And I think that Aschenbach probably identified that, maybe not on a conscious level, but identified that within himself. And that was part of the connection between the two of them. That's sort of how I got that feeling, is that despite everything and despite their age difference and despite the difference in their beauty and all that kind of stuff, that was the connection that the two of them had, or at least that he projected onto Tadzio. Whether it's true or not, the real Tadzio lived to be 80 years old, so, but subconsciously at least, that shared near-death experience or that shared end-of-a-lifetime experience just was another bond between the two of them, is how I interpreted that.
I thought he might be a Christ figure. That he's just too perfect to be real in a way.
Well, he's certainly a godlike figure. I mean, he equates him with the god, the world of the gods. Of course, at one point in the opera, he suddenly imagines the only two people alive left on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, he remembers that, and it's a bit pathetic. He realizes it's a bit pathetic as a concept.
That's a very powerful thought when he has that.
It is.
Wow,
absolutely, yes. The whole thing comes to a halt for that moment. And, of course, when he's listening to the clerk in the bureau telling him that there's plague, the first man who tells him really the truth about the situation, about the cholera sweeping across Europe and so on and into Venice. Actually, I don't always have the same thought. I'm just listening. And the clerk scene is the longest extended solo singing section in the piece. It's like an aria. I sometimes think, oh my goodness me, poor Tadzio, not me, poor me, poor Tadzio, that's going to be the end of him. Sometimes I think it's poor me, sometimes I think poor us. Sometimes I think we might avoid the infection. I don't stick to one thing, it seems to vary, and I don't make a sort of conscious decision. And I think they're all perfectly valid, actually, for him in that situation. It's a traumatic thing he's hearing, but how it affects him does seem to vary a little bit to me.
Why do you think, as a performer, that changes each night? Are you trying to listen to it freshly each night?
Yes, I really don't know. I mean, I think it can be all of those things, actually. All of them and one or two of them, or one of them. It may be something to do with the way that Tom sings it. Maybe there's a different emphasis or something, or the way I feel that night. But those feelings do change, do vary from one show to the next. Although the outcome is still the same, I'm still left knowing I've got to tell them and then I can't.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that happens a lot when you're on stage, that you sort of
try and keep an open mind?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're as much as you can, not just in Death in Venice.
Mm-hmm. And is that something that happens in other language operas as well?
Yeah, I would say so, yes. Yeah? I try and, try and keep a bit of one's brain open to something different happening, or don't just come on and close down and write, this is how it goes. I think it's more interesting and more exciting for me and maybe the public if you can have a little bit of you that's kind of thinking, well, it may not be that, and just see what happens.
As opposed to the grocery list.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there's a huge scope for that in this as well, because I have all those recitatives, which I can more or less do as I like. I mean, there's a note, but no values, for instance, just dots. there's a huge scope there for.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the recitatives have no note values, just really? Pitches. So if I go, I have always kept a close watch over my development as a writer, that's entirely my rhythm. So I could go, I have always kept a close watch. I could do that. I could do anything I want.
You can change the emphasis.
Absolutely.
Is that unusual? I mean, I'm not musical, I don't know.
I mean, Stuart Bedford is very interesting about it, but that's what Britain decided to do in this case. That would give enough freedom to the singer to use the correct word emphasis, but the pitch, he decided. He wanted that pitch.
And would, for example, that particular phrase come within a certain amount of time? Is it a certain number of bars? No, not really.
So it's way back to, you know, it goes back to the days of plain chant, that sort of thing, where the performer, and then think of monks or me, they decided how long the things would take. Occasionally, just occasionally, I do something and it coincides with either something in the piano who's accompanying or the orchestra, just occasionally does that. Or he might say slower or quicker, but what does that mean? That's up to me, up to the performer what that means.